Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
Good evening. This is the 20th of 36 cities on this tour. So I do this either every evening or every other evening. Like I just came from Oklahoma City, where they defaced my posters because I'm an instrument of Satan. So be warned. Be warned. The elders of the church we were speaking in got very frightened, so they asked to meet with me beforehand, and they quizzed me just 10 minutes before I was to speak and in this huge church. And they said things like, well, just tell us, are you New Age? In kind of an accusatory way. And I said, well, I'm going to be 60 next year. How new could that be? Not a smile, nothing. Oh, dear. At some point I said, you know, I really love Christ. One of the men said, then you're a Christian. I said, I'm everything. I'm a kind of a Sufi, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu. I used to take off my shoes in front, but I felt too much like Mr. Rogers, and I thought, Well, what these evenings are a chance for us to hang out together. Now, I know you came somewhere and you got a ticket and you came and sit down and I'm up here and you were there, and that's a form. But I'm experiencing it a different way. I mean, this is all, I can see this reality. I haven't lost it, which is really all I have to prove after 400 acid trips. I just have to prove that I'm not totally psychotic, and already I'm a piece of datum. Now, in my reality, you're in your living room, wherever you're comfortable, and I've dropped by, and I tell stories well. And I'm a mouth for a process that many of us are going through. I really don't assume there's anything I know you don't know. And so what I've found over the years is that the more intimately I deal with how it is for me, the more intimately I'm sharing with you what it is with you. Because there is something common in our experience of people that would come to hear Ram Dass. And it's a certain kind of a network. It's a kind of a network of consciousness, and it's like the stage we're at. We're flickery. We know something, but we're not sure we know it. We don't trust it, but we know it. And so when you come together and you find there are a lot other people as crazy as you are, you know, it allows a new kind of reality to come in. See, the interesting thing is that you and I have all of the data in our experiential showcase that we're all living in, all the data for you to realize who you fully are. However, because of the cultural context in which we dwell, very often you treat a lot of those data as either non-existent or irrelevant. or quaint. Let me give you an example of changes that have occurred in the culture that may make it now possible for us to have a conversation acknowledging something we know together. Over the last 20 years, this is one of the facts I delight in playing with. Over the past 20 years, there has been an increasing curve in the, I don't know, Roper or Gallup poll about the numbers of widows who report having conversations with their dead husbands. That curve's been going up for 20 years. Well, I reflected about that. It seemed interesting. And the first thought I had was, suppose 20 years ago, dead husbands weren't talking to their wives. But that didn't seem likely, so I considered the other two alternatives that I could think of. The second alternative was the dead husbands were indeed talking to their wives 20 years ago, but their wives weren't listening to them. Or the other alternative was dead husbands were talking to their wives were listening to them, but they weren't admitting it. And it's a combination of the last two, I think. And then some of us, when this stuff exists, but we notice it, but we don't know what to do with it, because we think it's kind of crazy, so we say, I was out of my mind, or I don't know what came over me. We have a lot of little phrases to make irrelevant probably the one thing that will save us. Isn't that funny? Many incarnations ago, when I was a professor of psychology, at Harvard, I remember we treated intuition like a really dirty word because I was in cognitive psychology, among other things, motivation and child development. And because we were so sexist in our social scientific arrogance, we said, women intuit. Men think. Okay. And we were so felt that men really had the edge. Boy, how wrong we were in so many ways. How trapped in our minds we were. But I guess that's what you expect in universities. I mean, it's a temple to the mind, and the professors are the high priests. Who goes there but people that want to worship the mind? We're in an interesting dialogue inside ourselves. I was teaching last year at St. John the Divine Cathedral in New York City. And it was a course on working around helping and serving. And there were about 200 or 300 of us in the course, and all of us were required. It went on for about 7 sessions, 14 weeks. All of us in the course were required to volunteer to do some service around homelessness in New York City, either a soup kitchen or a shelter or a political action around fair housing practices or real estate developers or whichever one. However you felt you uniquely wanted to play, but you had to do something and you kept a diary, and then we had an open microphone. And people could share what they were putting in the diary. And one woman said, I'm working in a soup kitchen. I don't remember whether she said soup kitchen or shelter. She says, that isn't really what I want to talk about, what's in my diary. What's in my diary is that for the past year or so, every time I leave my apartment, when I go to the corner to the store or to the bus, there is the same man quite often begging on the corner with a paper cup. He's the kind of local homeless person. And she said, for the past year, I've been giving him a quarter sometimes and sometimes not. And she said, I'm a little embarrassed to say it, but I basically have a budget for him, like $250 a week. It's like a user's tax for middle classness. If you want to use middle class, you got to pay a tax. She said, but I, as a result of this course, I realized that I had never acknowledged his existence as a human being. She said, I saw that I was afraid. And I asked myself, what am I afraid of? I'm not afraid he's going to rape me. It's daylight. I'm not afraid he's going to steal my pocketbook. After all, we've known each other for a year. And she said, I kept looking, and I suddenly realized that I was afraid that if I acknowledged him, he'd end up living in my house with me. What she was saying was that if I opened my heart to this other human being, how would there be boundaries? Because the quality of the deepest heart is boundarylessness. I mean, when you're in love with somebody, when you're in love with them, where are the boundaries? You want my car? Take it. You need my house? Take it. Want my time? Of course. What? But the mind, on the other hand, that has a different function. The mind is there as the computer central for your spacesuit for this incarnation. It's job is to keep you surviving as a separate entity, keep you from embarrassment and destruction, psychologically and physically. So when the heart goes to give away the store, the mind says, now wait a minute, you have your health insurance coming due in 2 days. So this woman was saying that the way that she was handling being part of the haves in an increasing ocean of have-nots was by making her heart her enemy and closing down her heart to more and more people who became them instead of us. And I'm sure she felt that she had her heart very open to her children, to her husband, and to her families, and her friends, her personal friends. But there's an incredible, interesting cost in closing down the heart at any time, for anything. Because the heart isn't just, I mean, there's all these, the word heart is a funny word. We really are slobs the way we use language. Because you don't know whether I mean the anatomical heart. You assume I'm not, because I'm not here giving a medical lecture. Well, I might mean the emotional, relational heart, because that's what romantic poetry is about. And that's sort of what most people mean when they talk about heart. But then behind that, there's another thing, another, forget the word thing, strike it. There's another, which the Chinese call the sin sin, for example, H-S-I-N, dash H-S-I-N, which means the heart mind. It's the space not of loving, but of love. It's the space not of becoming, but of presence. It's the space of no boundaries. So it's the space in which you grok everything, for example, in the Heinleinian sense. because you are everything. It is your subjective doorway into the universe. And as such, it is a doorway through which sustenance is fed to you, because you are connected to the source, which is all of it. That's the root through the source. In Hinduism, they call it the Atman. You can call it the Christ consciousness or the Buddha mind, or, you know, you can pick it, whatever you want. The Garden of Allah. And this heart mind, this inner space, this place, is a doorway into all the rest of who you are, other than who you think you are, because the mind thinks it's somebody. I mean, give it that. When you were born, you obviously came undifferentiated. You know, you didn't say, well, here I go, I'm being born. I mean, you did, but you didn't. You understand? There was no I at that point. But then you went into somebody training, because your parents knew you were somebody. I mean, they knew they were somebody, so they obviously had to train you to be somebody, because somebodies can't train nobodies. Which is interesting. They try, but they can't. It's like religion. It's like the priests in religion trying to train you in nobodiness. I'm the priest, now listen to me. Wavy Gravy is a member of the board of Seva and a very deep, wise human being. And for the past two elections, as you many of you know, Wavy, he did it on the side of a big bus. He's run nobody for president. It's got great slogans like, nobody can solve our economic problems. One of his best ones is, nobody cares. And he pointed out that nobody received more votes than all the rest of the candidates put together in the last election. Well, let's take it step by step. You go into somebody training and you become somebody, and you preen it and train it and collect it and define it, and you have ego and ego structures and phenomenal fields and all that stuff, and you're somebody. And you compare yourself to other somebodies, and you're more somebody or less than everybody else on this dimension or that. That's the world of somebody. And you're definitely somebody. The predicament is that for you and I, something has happened that has screwed up that as being the only reality. We've seen behind what Rilke calls just beyond the billboard at the edge of town. We've seen too much. We saw that our somebodyness and the whole reality that that represented was just another one. For me, that happened in the 60s. There was an awakening to the realization that I wasn't who I thought I was. That I had been had by my culture. Well-meaning, I mean, that's the scariest part. So at first, when you realize that you've been for 30 years standing sort of in the wrong place, and you really just scrunched yourself into this like prison. See, that's an interesting moment. Gurdjieff, the Russian philosopher, says you have to realize that in order to escape from prison, the first thing you must realize is that you're in prison. If you think you're free, no escape is possible. See, because you don't yet see it's a prison. But that any definition of yourself is a container. Well, at first, when I felt that, I felt like I'm really sick. feel at. Everybody else seems to be happy in their containers. Yeah. So I went to a therapist. Who helped me reorganize the furniture in the prison cell. Because a therapist thinks they're a therapist. And somebody can't help you escape. Nobody can help you escape. Such wisdom tonight. So then I figured, well, that isn't the route. And all the maps of how to escape, they send you maps like the Bhagavad Gita, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, or, you know, there are maps, lots of maps. And you start to read the maps and follow them and do the practices and all that sort of thing. But because I had felt so trapped by the world I had lived in, I developed a grudge against it. And I became much more of a renunciate. In a way, I was pushing away the physical, psychological plane because it had trapped me. And I was going to escape from it by, quote, getting high. I was going to push it away and get out, which I did by thousands of different techniques. But there was something wrong in that. There was something unstable in it, partly because I was like a horny celibate. I was busy not having desires, like, you know, non-smokers. I haven't smoked in 2 years, 3 months, 2 days, and 22 minutes. Those are the people that die of not smoking. And all the seeds of whatever my incarnation was about were just sort of waiting to sprout the minute there was a little water. And I finally realized at some point that the game was not to get high, but to be free, and that there was really nowhere to stand. And if I stood anywhere, I was just going to contain myself, and then I was going to be imprisoned again if I... And I had to turn around and look at everything that was an attachment and an aversion, and then start to... Let go. So I would stand nowhere. My spook friend Emmanuel helped me a lot. Emmanuel is a disembodied being that speaks through a woman named Pat Rodegast. Probably that awakens some prejudice in some of you. You know, you say, well, I'm not a prejudiced person. I mean, your race and color and age don't make any difference, but you have to have a body. I don't have that prejudice, and he's a great friend. It's great to have somebody that died, because you can ask him all kinds of wonderful questions. So I said to him, Emmanuel, what'll I tell people about dying? Because they all want to know. He said, Ram Dass, tell them that death is absolutely safe. That's a superb one-liner, by the way. He said, it's like taking off a tight shoe. So I said to Emmanuel, what am I doing here? Who made this error? You know, like, I look around and everybody's got the Buddhist five hindrances. Everybody's got sloth and greed and lust and hatred and ill will and agitation and doubt. I mean, what am I doing among these beings? And Emmanuel then said a very wise thing. He said, Ram Dass, you're in school. Why don't you try taking the curriculum? Try being human. Extraordinary. I mean, I'd never thought of that. I mean, if something's burned you, you don't go back and stick your hand in the fire. Or do you? See, finally, fire is your purification. That's what happens. To go into water, which is all wonderful and pleasant, is fine. That's like hanging on to what you got. But to play with the edge of where you aren't because you want to be free, that's fire. It's playing with fire. And for me, my fire was my humanity. How close could I get to be really human? How passionate can a non-attached being be? Can you be fully in the world and fully not in the world at the same time? Does passion require attachment? So at that point, I turned around. I remember turning around, I mean psychologically, and looking at my humanity as my curriculum. And then saying, well, what are the courses that make up the curriculum? Well, there's family, you know, 106. There's my old father. He's tired. He's ill. He's done well. You know, he's my stepmother's not well. It would be good if I lived there and took care of them. I don't just base there. That would be learning family 105, because in order to honor my human incarnation, it has a lot of components to it, and one of them is that I'm a member of a family. What does it mean to honor it? Does it mean to do everything they say? No, that's just their minds. It means to listen your way into, quote, what they call in the East, your dharma, your way, so that if you're grabbing at being a family member or pushing away being a family member, you're not free in form. The freedom in form comes from neither aversion nor attachment, but just fulfilling. You just kind of die into, in this case, sonness. And there was Dad being dadness, his dadness. And through those 10 years or so, it was far out. I mean, I went from where people would say to me, aren't you good taking care of your father? Can you hear that? That's like sacrifice. Why would you be sacrificing? Well, you'd be sacrificing your independence. And somehow we got into a wonderful set of myths about independence. And we got so enamored of the myth of independence that we kept cutting off all of our lifelines that fed us. Because I don't mean being related as an individual to the family, I mean being part of the family. Part of the family being part of your identity. You're a member of a family. Not just a separate entity relating to family, but actually that's another definition of yourself as a member of a family. And when you go into certain tribes and cultures, you can feel that their basic identity is in their social role or in their family identity, more than in their personal individual, what's in it for me kind of concept. And I ended up, when Dad died, feeling what grace I had. I was given that opportunity to surrender that much into just being a part of the family. And realizing that as I did that, I got fed by that acknowledgement. And suddenly I felt fulfilled by having been able to take care of my father in the last years of his life. Now, you can take them one at a time. I mean, you can take each of our different parts of our incarnation, like your sexual identity, your identity with a nation state, your identity with a community, your identity with certain values, your identity with certain age. Identity is part of an ecosystem, it's part of a cosmology. To honor means to honor all of them. You are all of it, and you're, you know. The myths of individuality are the myths of the mind, of the intellect. They're very afraid of the connection that the heart has with all things. But you and I have started to trust our intuition. We don't fully trust it yet. But we're beginning to recognize that there is a way in which we are already wise. There are certain things we know. We know that it really allows things to stay open and living between human beings when they are as truthful with each other as they can be. We know that. I know that, don't you? And yet, what we find is that we're living in social institutions that don't reflect that inner thing we know. I mean, we all watch Oliver North say, I lied to Congress, you know, for the good of whatever. And that's the social institution, one of them we live in, where everybody says, of course he lies to Congress. And they say, wouldn't you? That's a good one. There are things we know in our intuitive heart about compassion, for example. Because if you have opened, if you know that connection to all things, you may be scared shitless of it, but if you know of it, if you know you're part of an ecosystem and you're part of a social ecological system and you're part of family and you're part of all that, you have an identity with all of that. And then the predicament is that all the suffering in it is your suffering. And there's part of you that knows that. And as you realize that to be fully human, you have to embrace all suffering. That's so far out. Because most of us are building our sanity on the denial of suffering. I mean, how do you and I get hold of the fact that today, perhaps 35,000 women watched their babies die of malnutrition? I mean, take any one of those mothers and then multiply it by 35,000 every day. How would you handle that kind of vastness of suffering? How you handle that determines whether you get fed by life and whether you stay alive in the universe. Because if you deny it in order to be happy, that happiness is not true happiness. And that's part of the problems with our myths in this culture. Because our myths create the model that if you become the most somebody in your specialness, and you acquire in any way possible, you are a hero figure within that mythic structure. I mean, I call your attention to Donald Trump, for example. Now, you may snicker and not want him as a mythic hero figure, but he is. He is a hero figure in this culture. And when I look at that, it's a little like, you know, in those tribes where they take a maiden and they honor her for a year and then they boil her or throw her off a cliff or something like that. I mean, I'm not... The Donald Trump myth, not Donald Trump, he's just a poor schlump that's caught in the... He's been selected to play out the myth. You know, and he gets the feeling of, wow, I'm Donald Trump. Enjoy, baby, you can have it. I mean, Donald Trumpness is an obscenity. Because how must a person close their heart to keep so single-minded on that while all around them are the have-nots and the people that are falling by the wayside just because of the way he is living? And I say, I'm not talking about the human being that's Donald Trump. I'm talking about the role. as Thomas Berry said, we have a dysfunctional cosmology. It just doesn't work for what we need at the moment. It just doesn't work. How could you possibly keep your heart open to all that suffering? Because wouldn't your heart break? Wouldn't the emotional part of your heart break? Because you can only conceive of being that open to that suffering in your human form with your attachments. And if you let the fact that there was a baby starving into your consciousness, what are you going to do? Say, what do you say? Let's go see my left foot tonight. Because the emotional heart would glom onto that, and the suffering would be so intense, and you'd have to do something about it to stop it. And this is one of the fiercest paradoxes that the full incarnate of a human being seems to have to learn. And put baldly is, it's perfect and it stinks. And they're both true. And now what are you going to do? Because there is a plane of reality in which you pull back as if you were a physicist or a whatever, geneticist or anything, astronomer with a Hubble telescope. You pull back until you see how it is. That's what we're going to see with the Hubble, and we'll see. Boy, are we uninteresting. We certainly are making a lot of to-do about nothing. We aren't even passing show. We're those bugs, like those bugs that are born in the morning and die in the evening, and around noon they say, boy, that's life. Yeah. Yeah. You get to this plane of reality, you just keep pulling back and pulling back. You can do it through just following your breath, like in Vipassana or something like that. You pull back and you pull back until you just see it's all things are related to each other lawfully. I don't mean law like human law. I mean like the Tao, the way of things. You feel the harmony, the balance, the forces, the actions and the reactions, the codependent arising. You just feel the wisdom of form. You feel a deeper wisdom, and you stand in awe and reverence, and that's what people like Einstein always knew. They realized how close they were to the feeling the plan of God, or what that whatever that unfolding wisdom is of form. And when you see that, you are awestruck and you say, it's all perfect. But then you come back into your human emotional heart, and everywhere you look, there's pain and suffering in yourself, in your family, in your friends, in the culture, everywhere. With the earth, you say, perfect. It's horrible. It stinks. What is this suffering? Who thought this one up? I mean, if I were God, I'll tell you. I wouldn't have screwed up like this. Remember people coming to Ramana Maharshi, who was a great Indian saint, and they'd say, Ramana Maharshi, is the earth going to survive? He said, you don't even know who you are yet. What are you even, what are you worried about that for? Like, look who's asking the question. Remember that story about the rabbi comes into the shul and he goes up and he stands before the ark and he kneels down and he's beating his chest saying, I'm nothing, I'm nothing, I'm nothing. And the cantor comes in and sees the rabbi doing this. He figures it's really something to do. So he goes up and he kneels down next to the rabbi. He's going, I'm nothing, I'm nothing, I'm nothing. So the janitor comes in and sees the rabbi and the cantor. And he goes up and he kneels down next to the cantor. And he says, I'm nothing, I'm nothing. And the rabbi nudges the cantor and says, look who thinks he's nothing. It's one of my father's stories. predicament is that the myths of individuality don't give the return that they promised. They don't make people content. Donald Trump is not content. And neither is George Bush. I mean, he looks like he's content, but he isn't. And you know he isn't. Because he can't give full vent to his humanness. If you push anything away, you're off balance and you're not content. Content is being with what is. Ah, yeah. The horrible beauty of it all. The incredible poignancy of the human predicament, of the earth predicament. Here's an interesting statistic. In another poll that was taken of realizing your dreams, people that made $15,000 a year said, if I made $50,000, I could realize my dreams. People that made $50,000 said, if I made $100,000, I could realize my dreams. In the question, have you realized your dreams? 5% of those making $15,000 said, yes, I have realized my dreams. Of the people making $100,000, 6% said, yes, is it worth it? I mean, I think that's what cocaine use is about in the middle class. Is the failure of the myths. It's a symptom of the failure of the myths. And the myths fail because they are only of the mind. They are not of the balance of the mind and the heart. I mean, the Native Americans, whom we almost succeeded in performing genocide on completely, or driving to drink, they understood the balances, and the ones that are left, some of them still do. Funny, we were killing off just the kind of wisdom we need at this point, because without it, we're starving to death. We're in our minds, and our minds are science and technology and all the excreta they produce. And we are just getting the full cultural realization that our minds can certainly produce a lot of garbage, worrisome stuff. I mean, I love the dialogue about nuclear waste. The one, we of the Department of Energy have decided that we're going to dig a hole 2 miles long and 2 miles wide in a sand cavern and make barrels that are double strength and put all of the nuclear waste underground, and there the salt will enlarge and it will protect everything for... How long is that life, the toxic life of nuclear waste? 250,000 years? Are you sure it's going to work? Well, our research shows. Did you do research for 250,000 years? It's 100 times longer than recorded history. Well, we extrapolated for, aha, we have a theory. I mean, just the realization of the fact that our minds, trying to do good, create cheap energy that would make everybody have more, a better life. Our minds, because we fully couldn't tune so we could wonder about the implications of our acts, have created difficult situations. And when you're in the mind, you can become extremely repressive and even violent when you're just caught in the mind. You get very frightened. and you start to do stuff that you just couldn't do if you were in your heart. Like a memo slipped out of the Department of Energy that said, we don't really know this thing's going to work at the Carlsbad Caverns in New Mexico, but that's a low population, very poor area, and it's really what we'll call a sacrifice zone, which didn't sit well with the people of New Mexico. I mean, I don't have to go there because you have Rocky Flats, your good fortune. And it looks like all the king's horses and all the king's men can't make that land fit to live in for the next many 10,000 generations or something. I really encourage you to stay very vigilant and not to just trust good father figures on this one. Yeah. Because they have an agenda. They have the agenda of the mind, and the mind is concerned with control and mastery. And I thought Joanna Macy had a great suggestion. You probably all know this, but she said, you know, we don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. Nothing we theorize will work, may work, or may not. The only safe way is, at the moment that we know, is to keep it above ground and monitor it. So let's build these huge shrines of nuclear waste, and then we'll have a monk's order, like the Peace Corps, who'll give a year to monitor, and then people can make visits to these pilgrimage sites to see the product of our era. And we'll just turn it around into something that we can use to become wise. Probably the government's not going to buy that model, but it appealed to me. The increasing polarization between the haves and the have-nots is a product of mind, not of heart. All the social, all the root sources of the deepest myths of our culture, which we've cut ourselves off from, like the Bible, Old and New Testament, and the Republic, all were rooted in the balance between the mind and the intuitive wisdom, the higher wisdom. Like 50 of 55 of the people that worked on the Constitution, and roughly the same proportion in the Declaration of Independence, were all Freemasons. And Freemasonry wasn't just a social club. Freemasons were an order concerned with higher consciousness, a practicing order, and the members of that framed all these documents, which were based on the understanding as that the only way the game works on this plane is to recognize that there are other planes of reality. So you have a context for living in this one. So that you've got to keep always open to the deeper truths of reality as you govern this one. And they look to the leaders to do that. And that's what the dollar bill, the pyramid with the little pyramid above with the eye in it, that's the upper wisdom and that's the earth wisdom, and they must stay close together and come together for the pyramid to be whole. And it's time for us to reread those documents from where our consciousness is now, not because most of the people that are only in their minds, who are like the Supreme Court for the most part, I mean, not totally, by the way, but mostly. They can't read the documents anymore. They're like maps that they're not standing in the right place to be able to understand them, so they keep misinterpreting them. I mean, Jefferson was freaked when he went to France and saw the discrepancy between the rich and the poor. He said, you can't build a stable government on a thing like that. But our myths of individuality and consumerism and all that built these myths where mythic figures can do that, and where Thomas Keating, whatever his name is, Keating, not Thomas, Mr. SNL, you know, can justify his salaries or all these bizarre salaries. Well, I worked hard that year. $80 million worth, you know. A lot of strain in my job. Yeah, well, if your kids were starving to death, there's a little strain too. I had this extraordinary experience. I was in Guatemala for the SEVA Foundation. And we work in these villages up in the Altiplano that are villages where these Mayan Indians live that are extreme. I mean, when you'd meet one, if you haven't, you see somebody who is still simple in the true sense of simplicity, of connected, of there, like trees and rivers. And these villagers, many of them have been murdered. Mostly the men, the husbands and the sons, have been murdered. By the army, and then the violence that happened a few years back, and the army was in the service of the wealthy people, which is about 4 or 5% that controls about 80% of the land. So that all these Mayans who were starving to death have nothing, and they keep banding together to figure out what to do about it. And our government, of course, backs the wealthy people against this communist threat. So now that it isn't a threat, maybe we'll reconsider our Central America policy. But at any rate, there I was in this village where all the people were sitting in fear. We were helping them with water supplies and tool banks and the stuff of getting their life back together again in a way that is respecting of them and joining with them as family members and so on. And I just, I mean, these are my people. They're my friends. And they are sitting, waiting, frightened that the rich are going to come in and murder them again. And I flew from there to Hollywood, where I had an appointment. And I found myself in, I think it was Brentwood, which is a kind of a posh suburb, like near Beverly Hills. And as I drove down this street, there were all these huge estates, all with walls. There were no people on the street, just these walls with electric gates, with electronic things, devices. Just going down all these fortresses, one after another. And on the lawns of each one, the security department had put the same sign. It was red with black lettering, and it said, "Armed Response." I thought, isn't this bizarre? I just came from a place where the poor are waiting for the rich to come in and murder them. And there are an awful lot of people who are in the have-not class, and it's growing all the time because all the multinationals and all, there's a redistribution, so fewer and fewer people are controlling more and more of the resources. That's all based on outdated myths, a dysfunctional cosmology. It's time for a paradigm shift. One of the things that's so profound about the moment we find ourselves in, besides this instability that that our economic situation has created, and the uncertainty that our exploitation of resources has created ecologically, but politically, it's all up for grabs. Extraordinary. And that's one of the interesting doorways in, because what happened, I mean, we've suddenly got all these new role models. Have you noticed? We have President Havel of Czechoslovakia. We have the Dalai Lama, great politician, People said, aren't you angry at the Chinese? He said, no, that wouldn't be functional. We have Nelson Mandela. We have the student in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square. We have Mother Teresa. I mean, we have the emergence of a lot of role models or myth figures or whatever for shifting understanding of it all. But how exciting that all those governments in Eastern Europe who were repressed for so long and suddenly realized that the institution they were repressed by was a creation of mind, and their heart rose up and said, the mind is off the wall, baby, and they're going at the wall. Literally. It's nice. I mean, I thought the wall was real, didn't you? Did you know it was just made of paper mache? But all of them then said, well, now what we'll have is democracy. And then they said, well, what's democracy? It's interesting. So we had all these, we have all these space bridges. Our people meet with their people, and they say to us, what's democracy? You people are democracy. But as we examine what we are in the mirroring of what it is they're yearning for, it's interesting what we're seeing about how we have interpreted democracy. Because when the top of the pyramid isn't connected to the bottom of the pyramid, democracy starts to be a system based on units of consumers. It's an economic unit system. And the social and the moral and the idea that every being in a social system that's a democratic system should have the opportunity to realize their fullest potential. Boy, we certainly offer inner city kids a lot of chance to realize their inner potential, don't we? Have you noticed lately? Well, they're not really members of society, I mean. We don't mean them, we mean us. So the mind gets frightened, it contracts and contracts and contracts.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman. A weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.